Alan Crane Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2022. Today, yield curves and forward rates. This is a continuation of the lecture from Monday, and I'm hopeful that you will take some of this. Part of it is actually kind of interesting. The last part is some math that might fog you a little bit. I'm going to take you through it in a way that will get you as far as possible without killing yourselves. Certainly, it will be. I hope you'll be able to do the homework problem that has to do with forward rates. But along the way, we have to go through the details of interest rates in general, finish up that, and also you'll have a story that I will tell you about the history of interest rates, a relatively recent history over the last 50, 60 years. And then from there, a little bit of hard math, and that'll be the end of it. I'm hopeful that I'll maybe even be able to let you out a little early because of that brutal last piece that I do. But before we go there, a look at the markets. So as we go through this, now, madam, is this a bull day or a bear day? It's a bull day. I'm in a bear position. So today I have lost a couple of grand because of the stupid optimism this market is showing right now. Fortunately, it took a turn downward. The bears began to grab a hold there in the last 15, 20 minutes before the bell. You began to see some sliding there. So there's that. But overall, money was flowing into equities. Now, if we go over here, crude oil actually pushed up too. It's not anywhere terrible. Remember, I told you it wanted to stay in that band from $82 to $89 per barrel on the light sweet Brent, but it went down into the mid-70s, and now it's recovered back up to about $82, back into that band. That's not going to mean high gas prices. We're still well below those oil prices that were causing gas prices to be near $5 a gallon. But, I mean, we still should see the gas prices ease up a little bit from where they are right now. They had a spike there for a few days, but I think that should let up a little bit. So, in other words, and also gold was up, silver was up. So we had the equities, money was flowing to equities, money was flowing into the commodities, and over here in the bond market, well, yields were falling, which means prices were rising. And so money was flowing into bonds. So in other words, there was a broad-based optimism today. Money was, cash was being pulled out to buy stocks. Cash was being pulled out to buy commodities. Cash was being pulled out to buy bonds. So again, remember, yield and price are inversely related on bonds. So there we are. We are in a bullish kind of mood today. And I'm hoping they'll get over that rather quickly. Now over in last night, Tokyo, it had a plunge at the opening. That was the morning over there. Plunged, and then it just sat there most of the trading day in Tokyo. At the end, you saw a little bit of a bull rally. By the time the sun rose over in London, that was pretty much over with, and it was a bear market there, and it just turned bullish at the end. And then that bullish sentiment came over here to this side of the Atlantic, and when the sun rose over here, and the bulls were in charge all day long. They were just having a fun. There at the end, it looks like a little profit-taking was happening, that dip there near the end. But overall, it was a strong bull day. So there you are. Not the best news in the world for a bear as I have been recently, but it's definitely, there's a strong market out there right now. How long will it stay that way? Well, we'll see about that. Hoping it won't last more than another day before I give up altogether. Let me dig up a marker that actually writes. Okay, here we go. Now the first thing that I would want to do is just to review, just to put this number, this thing back up here again so I can talk about it. An interest rate has two big chunks. There is the risk-free rate, and then there is this beast called the risk premium. Now, inside of the risk-free rate are two pieces. There is the real rate, and then there is the expected inflation premium. The real rate is the one that is driven by supply and demand dynamics for money, with R sub real on the vertical axis and M, the amount of money, on the horizontal axis. The demand for money is a downward sloping curve. In other words, at high interest rates, people don't want to hold much cash balance because they can make money putting it away in a savings account or investments. But at low interest rates, the demand for cash balances is high because what are you going to do? Just keep the money in your pocket because you can't earn much putting it in the bank. Now, the way we traditionally draw the supply curve, at any given time, it's vertical. It's a perfectly inelastic amount of money, supply of money. And the quantity supplied, where the quantity supplied equals the quantity demanded, you have the equilibrium real interest rate at any given moment. Now, and to go back through again, we had in the 2017, the economy wanted to slide into a mild recession. The president at that time absolutely did not want that. And he even threatened to fire the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which no one had ever even heard of someone threatening that. And so the Fed printed money to lower interest rates to stimulate the economy. So the supply of money went out and interest rates went down to stimulate the economy. Unfortunately, the ultimate result of that is that if you just keep printing too much money, you are going to start to get inflation embedding, an expectation. In other words, it's not just prices rising, it's forward prices rising, an expectation, so that businesses will charge more now because they expect to have to pay more for their next shipment. People get earning money will want more now because they expect the erosion of inflation coming at them. And so ultimately, you will start to get a nasty backlash effect. The risk-free rate will start to slide upward. The only way to stop that is what the Fed has been doing here in recent months. It starts to crush the money supply. The big problem with that is that the money supply goes down, real interest rate goes up, but the expected inflation premium stays for a while because the markets aren't going to believe it when the Fed does what it did. Now, here's where a little bit of history comes in. Back 1950s, the 54 to 60, in that time period, 56 to 60, something like that, the president was a moderate Republican named Dwight Eisenhower, former general, generally considered to be the last of the great moderates of the GOP. He had given a tax cut that the Republican Congress had wanted early on, but when they demanded more and more tax cuts, he said, no, go to hell. But at the same time, he also, there was a lot of movement to get progressive programs started in the United States. And he said no to those too. And as such, he held a middle line that we had nearly balanced budgets. I think we actually did balance the budget one year, the last year he was in office. But we also did not have a very exciting economy. It grew at this rate of about 2.5%. Nothing glorious. Well, he was, he resigned, he didn't go for another term in office. I don't think he could. And the president who was elected in 60, 61, was a progressive Eastern liberal named John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was an odd composite. He was a consummate politician, worldly man, and all that. But he was also, he had visions. He was an anti-communist as hell. He had fought in World War II. He hated the communists. And so he was beginning to move us into a what was called at the time a police action in Southeast Asia to beat back the communist insurgencies in a god-awful place called Vietnam. And so we were fighting a theater war there. Then he also said, we are going to fight a war on poverty. If we can beat the Japanese, we can beat the Nazis, those filthy animals, we can fight a war and win it against poverty as well in this country. So in other words, money going into programs to advance to make better the prospects of poor people and all that. Well, he was killed, assassinated in 63, and I'll go through this again a little later in the course. But he was replaced by his vice president, Lyndon Johnson. Now, Johnson was an old conservative blue dog Democrat from Texas. And everyone was thinking, all the conservatives were thinking, well, thank God we got that liberal out of office and all that. Well, no, Johnson didn't stop Kennedy's program, In fact, in 1961, Kennedy, in a speech, said, we are going to put a man on the moon by the end of this decade. Of course, all the engineers and scientists said, yeah, sure we are, Jack. Wait, are you kidding? You're not kidding? Well, we did it. And Johnson was the one who pushed it. Why? Because Jack wanted it. Johnson escalated our involvement in Vietnam. And why? Because Jack wanted those communists beaten back. He then pushed for a Civil Rights Act like no one had ever seen because Jack wanted it. And all of that good stuff. And he fought the war on poverty, built the projects, you know, all those projects in places like Chicago and LA, food stamps, welfare checks, that was all in that era. Money being spent. Fortunately, we had strong taxes back then. The top marginal tax bracket at that time, in a healthy, growing, aggressive, worldly American economy, was 70%. So you think about that the next time you hear about crying about high taxes in our era, where our top tax rate on corporations is 21%. But anyway, Johnson didn't run for office again in 68, and Richard Nixon took over. Now, a lot of people might think Nixon was a hardcore conservative Republican. In many ways, he was. But he was also surprisingly progressive. In fact, he was the one who appointed the Supreme Court justices that comprised the most liberal Supreme Court in American history. He was the president who oversaw passing the Environmental Protection Act, the first legislation of its kind. So he wasn't a slouch when it came to government getting its nose in and fixing things. Unfortunately, in 1973, we pissed off the Arabs. I mean, we pissed them off. And they shut off the oil. And we had the OPEC oil embargo. The price of oil skyrocketed. The lines waiting for gas were just insane. I was there. I saw it. I even saw the black market. My brothers were buying gasoline on the black market. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Nixon got the Fed to print money to monetize the price shock. And of course, that once the Fed starts printing money, it just can't stop. And so we started printing the money and keeping the interest rates low, money in people's pockets. Nixon resigned in 1974 because of the Watergate scandal, and his vice president, Gerald Ford, took over. He was a moderate Republican, really, by all accounts, a really great guy. He wasn't an extremist right-winger, and he wasn't a terrible liberal. He was a negotiator. He saw both sides, and he'd find middle ground. But unfortunately, he had neither the political will nor possibly even the understanding of what was happening. We were starting to get embedded inflation. It was going in. Now, the way Ford thought he could handle it was by printing a million buttons people were supposed to wear that said, whip inflation now, when, as if we could just decide to stop inflation. That didn't work too well. And he was voted out of office in 76 by a president named Jimmy Carter. Now, Jimmy Carter was, in one way, a very simple, very conservative, religiously conservative peanut farmer. But he was also a liberal in many, many ways. And he was also had an advanced degree in nuclear physics. He understood what was going on. At first, though, he took on Ford's strategy, trying to just get people to stop inflating. In fact, his motto for his campaign was he called inflation the moral equivalent of war, unfortunately having the acronym MEOW. Well, that didn't work out too well, so he knew what had to be done. In 1979, he appointed a new chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker. And I'll spell these out in a future lecture. I'll do this again. Volcker, by all accounts, and he just died last year or early this year, he was a son of a bitch. Tall Paul, he was called. Big man, tall. Smoked cigars, he'd blow the smoke in your face if he didn't like you, the story went. He was just an asshole, and he crushed the money supply. He just cranked it down, okay? So, of course, that almost instantly sent the real rate of return through the roof as he crushed it down. But expected inflation stayed there because the markets didn't believe it. Well, we've heard the Fed say they were going to stop inflation. They don't. They do it for a few days, and then they go back to printing money. He didn't. He just kept crushing it down and down. We dropped into a near recession. We got something called stagflation. We had a stagnating economy because interest rates were skyrocketing. We had inflation, stagflation. Of course, Carter was voted out of office because people just didn't understand what was happening. And a former governor of California, also a former actor in cowboy westerns, also a former actor in cigarette commercials named Ronald Reagan, became president. Two things went on. By the time Reagan came into office, the expected inflation, see, the markets just didn't believe that this was real. And Volcker just finally, he just asked them the question, who's your daddy? He just crushed the markets until they were choking, and finally they began to believe him, and the expected inflation premium began to unravel. It started going back down, and Reagan and the Congress of the time passed a very large tax cut act, and that helped boost the economy too, and eventually the Fed could let up. Once the expected inflation had drained out, then the Fed could allow the money supply to start growing again. And so we went into the 80s with a fairly decent growing economy, a decent recovery. Cut of taxes, lower interest rates. So it looked like Reagan was a hero. In a way, he maybe was. And so we have that story going on of what the time frame was, as much as what the political and economic dynamics were. This time around, the Fed started printing money hard in 2017. Instead of letting the economy slip into a mild recession, they printed money hard. They printed more and more, and then when the lockdown happened under the rule of President Biden, Well, then we started printing COVID checks and PPP loans that we forgave and all of that. So the money supply started cranking up like nobody's business. This time, however, the Fed has gotten serious a lot faster. I mean, and I'll show you this in just a minute here. You can see that the Fed is just dead serious, right now serious, scaring the hell out of the markets with how serious they are with some of these drops in the stock market. You saw the stock market earlier this week, I believe it was, the S&P hit a multi-year low. I mean, they know that it's serious this time. The good news is that it's happening quickly. They're jumping right on it, and the markets will probably pretty quickly begin to let go of the expected inflation premium. And that will help interest rates, and then the money supply can start to grow at a normal rate again. Let me show you something here. Project and return on investment to project, ROI. Now, let's say you've got a company that's looking at three projects, Project A, Project B, and Project C. Project A has an ROI of 6% return on investment. Project B has a return on investment of 8%. And Project C has a nice, healthy ROI of 14%. Okay, let's say that the interest rate that this bank can command for capital is 5%. Starting off. Well, in a case like this, you're going to have the markets are going, the company's going to say, yeah, we'll take Project A, because the cost of the capital is less than what we'll get for investing. So, yes, and obviously all three of the projects, A, B, and C, will be accepted because they all exceed the cost of the capital. You're going to do all three of the projects. Now let's take the interest rate up to 7%. At this time, Project A is going to be rejected, because the cost of the capital is greater than the return that the project will bring to the company. Project B and C will still be accepted. But notice now one project for one company has been turned down. That means that the employment growth that would have happened because of it is not there. That means that the company is therefore not going to be as profitable, not as much revenue, not as much profit. So it's beginning to hurt the economy. Let's say now that the interest rate goes up to 10%. This company can get capital at 10% weighted average cost of capital. Well, obviously, they're not going to take Project A because they get 6% out of it. And they're not going to take Project B because they get only 8% for borrowing money at 10%. And then Project C is the only one that they accept. In other words, more loss of new employment, more loss of profit. All of this because interest rates are rising. This is pretty much simple how these rising interest rates will drive us toward a recession. There's another subtler thing that's going on here too. You see, lower return projects will have lower risk. Higher return projects require that you take greater risk. That's just the nature of the world. Do you see how, as the interest rate is rising, this company is being driven to take higher and higher risk only projects and not balancing them with low risk projects? In other words, as that cost of capital goes up, the company is going to aim by necessity at those projects that what we used to call in football were Hail Mary passes, the ones that are more likely to fail. This is what causes the bankruptcies in a recession. Companies just can't take those kinds of risks, or if they do, they get their asses kicked by them because consumers aren't buying their products because the consumers are being hurt by the high interest rates too. So in other words, this has a double-sided blade on it as interest rates go up. They, first of all, make companies reject projects that would create employment, create profits. They also drive companies to be obligated to take on risk, higher and higher risk. See, when you took on A, B, and C, your average risk was the average of 6, 8, and 14. But when you're in that interest rate environment of 10%, you're all on the risk of a 14%. Your company is a 14% risk company. So that's why you're going to see more bank failures. And that exacerbates the recession's impact. And it deepens it. That's just how it works. And this is just like logical mechanics. But it's kind of beyond the people who don't learn what you are learning here. They don't get that into their minds that a lot of times it's not some conspiracy theory, it's not some evil plan, it's just how it's done and how we fix problems that we've created or we faced before. Sometimes you have to fix a problem because you were stupid. Sometimes you have to fix a problem because you needed to fix it, like the COVID checks and all that kind of stuff. So one way or the other though, it's going to cause problems. It's going to have a backlash, as you're seeing right here. In the end, though, the sooner we begin to fix it, the sooner we finish fixing it. That is what the difference is between the 60s and 70s and what we do, what we're doing this time. The truth be told, that before there was even a thought of government intervention, in other words, the 1800s and into the earlier part of the 1900s, government was not touching, did not touch these problems. They just let things do whatever they were going to do. You know, markets will correct themselves. And the reality was that recessions overall were much longer and much deeper in that era than they have been since then. That's just the reality of it. The data does not dispute this. The data confirms that with the government's intervention, if it's done properly, we can get out of recessions a lot faster than we could before there was this kind of intervention. Truth be told, back in the 1800s, you would talk about recessions, not in quarters, but in years and possibly decades. Hell, before in the Renaissance, in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, you could talk about recessions and depressions that were centuries long, for God's sake. So yeah, we're doing better now. It's not perfect, it's not great, but we do know how to get it fixed. The question is, do we have the willpower to fix it quickly or to punt it down the road for someone else to fix later? But the longer we wait, the higher that expected inflation premium goes and the more it gets embedded, so the harder it is to shake out. It's just like a cancer. You get early detection, early treatment, you're through it in not a whole lot of time. But if it goes on too long, it will kill you. So that's why we're acting as fast as we are this time, and the pain is there, and all of the conspiracy theories and all of the politics of it are raging along. But in our world, it's just technocratic engineering, and we get it done. We don't bitch, we just get it done. We hope. But anyway, enough of that. Taking it on to the next step, the risk premium. That has three pieces to it. There is the default premium. That's a little extra addition of basis points because people will default on their loans. Now, that's why you will see people with high credit ratings get lower interest rates. That's exactly why it is, because the default premium on a creditworthy borrower is lower than the default premium on a high-risk borrower. We see this in corporate every day, every minute of every day. You see, corporations borrow money by issuing bonds. Now, every company and every bond has a credit rating that is given by one of three services. And I'll go through these services in detail in next week, I think it is, or 2 weeks. But the Standard & Poor's gives a credit rating, Moody's does, and Fitch does. Now, these credit ratings are strings of letters. Like, for example, S&P, a triple A is very credit worthy, the best credit rating. And the other services have similar ratings, but they do have differences in the letters and the pluses and numbers and all that. But anyway, okay, a triple A. So when the investors, the lenders to the company issues bonds, the investors buy those bonds, that means the investors are lending them that money, lending the company that money. So when the investors see a AAA bond, well, maybe they'll give it a coupon. They'll say, we want you to pay us 4% coupon every year for the life of the bond. But if they see a bond with a rating of single A or maybe double triple B, they'll say, oh, you're not as creditworthy. We're going to jack that up. You might see a 5% on that bond simply because it is riskier. The default premium is higher. We can even calculate down to the basis point what the investors are doing as far as default premium goes. It's pretty easy to do. I'll even show it to you in a couple of real life examples. But okay, and then you get down below that, you can get down into what is politely called high yield bonds, otherwise known impolitely as junk bonds, and like a low B's or C's, well, then those are going to carry coupons that will knock your knock the snot out of your nose because the default premium is high because there's a good chance that that company is not going to be able to finish paying the bond off. It'll stop paying the interest payments or it won't be able to pay the principal off, something like that. So an example would be Netflix. Netflix had borrowed way too much money and investors saw that, lenders. Look, you've got so much interest that you're paying, we're not sure that your operating income, EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, is going to stay above what you have to pay in interest. Therefore, we see a higher rate risk of default. In other words, times interest earned is that's operating income divided by interest is getting too close to one for our liking. So the credit rating agency gave Netflix a junk bond rating for this last issue. I think it was $1.2 billion or something like that. Junk bonds. And Netflix said, well, we need the money, so we're just going to pay this higher interest rate on those bonds. Now, notice an interesting thing. The higher interest rate will mean higher interest expense, which makes them even riskier. So Netflix is in a really bad position right now. It doesn't dare borrow any more money because it could end up getting a C rating. And Netflix is struggling with subscriptions and competition. And so, yeah, the default premium is very real. And we can even see the number itself for how much extra on the risk-free rate the default premium is laying in. It's pretty dramatic in a case like Netflix, which at one time was the darling of Wall Street and all that kind of stuff, how far they have fallen. Now I'm going to do the maturity premium. Now this one is an interesting little animal here. R sub M, the maturity premium. The longer a loan is, the higher this maturity premium is. Now, let me give you an example of this. You, sir, you are going to borrow money for a home, okay? So a mortgage loan, maybe a 30-year. Okay, the first thing is that I, the lender, am going to lend you the money at 6.5%, about what it is right now. Now, suppose in a couple of years, now I'm expecting to get 6.5% return on my investment for 30 years. Suppose interest rates fall, as we expect them to, down to about 4% in a couple of years. What are you going to do? No. Yeah, well, you will, but how do you? Well, actually, this is kind of unfair. You're a younger person. You don't know this trick yet. I'm looking for someone, some old geezer, and everyone's looking at me. Well, why don't you answer the question, Prof? Do you know what you would do if interest rates fall on a mortgage?
No.
Okay, you refi. You just refinance it. You go to another bank, I'd like a loan at 4%, and then you pay back the bank that you had 6.5% on. That's what everyone would do. In other words, I, the banker who lent you the money for 6.5% at 6.5% for 30 years, was expecting to get that 6.5% return for 30 years. And then you refi on me, and I get my money back, but I can lend it at only 4%. So I'm burned if interest rates fall. And the longer the loan is, the more likely it is that interest rates will do just that. Well, let's talk about the other side of it, interest rates on the upside. You, sir, you have a loan at 6.5%. Did you know that the average homeowner sells his or her house in about 7 years, goes to a new mortgage and all that? Okay, so let's say that you have a 6.5% loan. It's 7 years. Your family has grown. It was two people. Now you two people have six kids. Your brother is living in your basement, and your brother-in-law and his friends are doing something in the garage. They keep coming out with gas masks on. You need a bigger home, right? Okay, suppose that at year seven, you're thinking, well, I ought to get a new home. But what happens if mortgage rates have gone up to 11%? Nope, you're not going to get a new home. Why would you? You've got a 6.5% mortgage, you're going to hold that thing until Jesus comes back. So you see, I would love, the banker, I'd love to have you pay me off. Sell the home, pay off the mortgage. Because I could then lend that money out at the new 11% rate, but no, you're going to stay there. You're just going to build a deep pit and put your kids in there or something. I don't know. But you see that if interest rates go up, I'm burned. So in other words, as the term of a loan gets longer, the more probability there is that interest rates will go down or up. That's just the nature of diffusion. There's more uncertainty. So in other words, the maturity premium is going to rise as time goes along. And also there's that liquidity premium, which I talked about, but let me show you something about the maturity premium. I will show you how it is actually in numbers. You can see it. This is the Treasury. Now, the Treasury's yields have actually turned into a nasty thing. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But let's look at the Treasury yields early in 2022. Do you see how they rise smoothly? Never mind the 30-year, that's a weird animal. But do you see how they rise smoothly? That's just the rising, increasing maturity premium. That's all it is. It's a normal thing. As a matter of fact, we have something we call the yield curve. The yield curve plots the maturity of treasuries against time. Yield to maturity, YTM. So in other words, a healthy yield curve is an upward sloping animal. That's the maturity premium. And as you can see in that, see that data? Look at the first day of the year. See how smooth that is? That is a healthy yield curve. Slowly rising, maturity premium increasing, which is just the rational behavior of market participants. So this one is healthy. Now, you don't want this thing rising too aggressively. That, if it's too steep, that probably means that the markets are projecting down out there somewhere a rising expected inflation premium. So you don't want it to be really steeply arching, because that can be a little bit of a trouble. But I would tell you that that one at the beginning of the year, that you're seeing there in the data, that's actually a pretty healthy one. That's pretty normal. Now, the real nasty is what happens if there is the yields are going up and then they turn down and come back up. That is called an inverted yield curve. And every recession has been preceded 3 to 9 months by an inverted yield curve. Every recession. We can actually see them coming at us. And this one, now a couple of times the yield curve has inverted and the economy has just slid into a kind of zero growth place. But every recession that did happen, you can look back and say, oh, that was the inverted yield curve. I saw it earlier this year. The yield curve inverted earlier this year. And even in the FIL 240 class I was teaching at the time, I said, it's inverted. We're in trouble now. We're going to have a recession. And spank me, Jesus, we did have one. No, you see some people, well, we're not in a recession. Yes, we are. By the technical numbers, we're in a recession. It's not a horrible one, but we're there. Let me show you. Let me get down here. Look at that. Well, let me see if I can sneak up here a little bit. Oh, nasty. You see the inversion right here? Look at that. And that was a bad inversion too, because normally an inversion, you will see maybe the 7-year above the 10-year, a single notch. But in this case, it was screaming, we've got a recession, because it was the inversion was wide. You see, clear through here, you had an inversion. That was just yelling, we're going to go into a recession. And I called a recession, we have a recession. And so, of course, this was the flag that the recession was probably going to be simply the result of the Federal Reserve clamping down the money supply, and that will choke the economy. That's all it was. Now, interestingly, you can see that this inversion has been there for some time. See it through here? It's been holding on. And that's a little bit of a problem. But the good news is, if we come clear down here to where we are today, do you see how it's beginning to try to get itself righted? It's not there yet, but you see how the inversion is now only in here? That's good news. In other words, the inversion is now signaling us that we're beginning to reshape, we're beginning to pull this part up, and eventually the whole thing will be looking okay again. How long? First part of next year will be okay again. I see the inversion probably correcting itself by November, maybe not, but then after that, you'll see the economy itself beginning getting into a really serious good recovery by that time. But as you can see, the inversion is correcting, at least in the shorter end of the yield curve. So what you have here is actually a way to see the future. It's through a darkened glass, but at the same time, we do have ways, technical ways, that we can look and not just speculate, well, I feel. No one cares about the feelings. Look at what the numbers are telling us, and they do not lie to us. And this is where we can have at least some handle on how far out we should prepare ourselves, and how serious it's going to get. And we also understand the dynamics underneath it. This is entirely the result of the Federal Reserve clamping down on the money supply to choke off the expectation of inflation so that we get lower interest rates down the line. Right now, interest rates are pretty darn steep. They'll begin to ease up again, probably in the early part of next year. That's how the recovery will start, is when the interest rates start calming down. So in other words, what will ultimately happen is that the Fed will be able to control this and bring this down, and that will allow this part to start to get smoother on the upside. Now, how serious am I about you knowing this? I'm going to give you four pictures on the exam, and I'm going to say which one is an inverted yield curve, or which one is signaling a recession. It'll be that simple. If you know how to look at these, you got it. Easy points, just by knowing what picture means what. But it's something that almost no one, especially even people with college degrees, most of them don't do what you're doing. You're taking that extra step with the hard stuff. You do. And so you are one step ahead of everyone else. We still have to give them their bread and circuses. We have to give them their conspiracy theories and their politics. But then behind the curtain, we are the technocrats who fix the engine and understand those who do fix the engine. Not to make you elitist, but guess what? You're becoming elite in these classes. Where the hell was I? Okay, that's enough of that. One last time. God, that pisses me off. Bulls are really in charge today. Anyway, enough of that one. I'm going to show you one last thing. Now, this is a math thing, and it looks really opaque at first. And you're thinking, how the hell am I supposed to understand this? What I'm going to do is I'm going to show you enough of it that you can do the problem. There's a problem or two on your Cengage homework for this chapter. You can get through that, and I'll even show you a little formula that'll help you get it done. But underneath it, you have to be able to see something that I'm going to say a couple of times and let it just kind of soak in. And of course, I just deleted the daggone page. Okay, let me go back and get... Now, I'll show you real world. How this looks. Now, what you're seeing here, now the 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, 6 month on the yield curve, that's a little bit more opaque, and I'll explain that a little better in subsequent lectures. But look at the 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 10, 20, 30. Those rates are set by the market. I showed you in Yahoo. Really? There, that's the 10-year right there. The 10-year is that yield right there, 3.7050%. They're driven by the market. The market actually uses prices, but then those prices mathematically translate into yields to maturity. We can do that on the calculator, something hard. But that is actually showing what is on this graph for the 10-year. This one's a day behind, I think. Is it or not? That's at the beginning of the day. But one way or the other. See, these are market-driven yields. The price is set by buy and sell orders, and the yield is calculated as a mathematical consequence of the price. So these yields right here, and I'm pulling off the ones that are, wow, You know, I never noticed it. Do you see how the 1 and 2 year were almost flat and clear at the beginning? Oh, that's not September 9th. Okay. Anyway. But these, actually, the 1 year is on September the, well, let's look at it right now. On September the 28th, today, as of right now, the 1 year was a 3.99%. And then the 2 year was a 4.07%. Now the 1 year is a 1 year, so it is annualized. The one that is the actual is the one that is the annualized. The 2 year is actually not exactly the same. The market has set a composite rate. There is the 1 year annualized, and then there is a 1 to 2 year annual. And those taken together create the 2 year that you see. Let me explain it. I'll show you mathematically. Now, don't sweat this. It looks a little weird, the formula, the formulation of it. The 1 year and the 1 to 2 year create the composite 2 year. So what I'm seeing there, you see that 4.07%? That is the composite 2 year, but it's actually created by two pieces. The 1 year, one plus the R1. Now remember, interest rates are always one plus when you do math. Times the one plus R sub one comma two, that creates the one plus R sub two squared. Just go with me, follow with me on this. This thing right here is called the one to two year forward rate. That R sub 1 2 is the 1 to 2 year forward rate. In other words, that's what the market is implicitly saying. It thinks the interest rate will be from 1 year to 2 years. It thinks right now that R sub 1 is, what is that, 0.399. And there is a forward rate that tacks on for 1 to 2 years. And that is what creates 1 plus 0.0407. One, two. That's the squared is 2 years. Now, I'm going to give you a formula to do this in a minute here. But watch this. So in other words, if I were to solve for that forward rate, R sub 1 plus R sub 1, 2, it would be 1 plus 0.0407 squared over 1 plus 0.0399. So in other words, R sub 1, 2 is 1.0407 squared over 1.0399 minus 1. Watch. Just watch the number. Sometimes seeing the result kind of helps. So I'm going to take, well, I forgot to bring up my calculator again. I'm going to take the 1.04 0.407 squared and divide it by 1.0399 minus 1. Oh, look at that. So in other words, the forward rate, the 1 to 2 year forward rate is 4.15%. In other words, in a practical kind of way, if I take if I take 1 plus 3.99% times 4.15%, that's how the 4.07% was created. Now, markets don't think, they're not trading, thinking, well, what's the forward rate? It's happening. It is a consequence. So in other words, what we actually see here in that forward rate is what we probably will see, what the market thinks interest rates will be from 1 to 2 years. The market thinks that the 1 year should be right now about 3.99%. The market says, but for years 1 to 2, it's going to pop to 4.15%, and put together, those will make the overall rate 4.07%. These forward rates are like a whisper that tells us where the actual interest rate, the market thinks the actual interest rate will be from 1 to 2 years out. So in other words, the market says the 1 year rate is 3.99%. Then a year from now, until we're about year two, it will probably be up to about 4.15%. Taken together, that would mean that from 0 to 2, overall, we're at 4.07%. Like I said, the market isn't actually calculating the forward rate. It is a consequence of the yields that are happening in the market right now. Now let me show you one more. Now I've gotten this one. Let's take the next one. Okay. So I can now say 1 plus R, the 1 year, times 1 plus the 1 to 2 year times the 1 plus 2 to 3 year should create the 3 year 1 plus R3 cubed. 3 years 3, 2 years 2. So now that I know the 1 plus 0.0399, the 1 year rate. I know the 1 plus 0.0415, 1 to 2 forward. I don't know the 1 plus R3, but I do know the composite 1 plus 0.04. What is it for that one? 1 2. You can do this for as long as you want. And you can. I hope you can see that this is Excel work. And I will tell you this right now. I will not ask this on an exam or a quiz, but it is in your Cengage homework, so I want to make sure that you have my way of showing it as well as Cengage, the book's way of showing it. So now, just to finish this up, I can say, okay, 1.0412 cubed over 1.0399 times 1.0415 will equal 1.0412 cubed. Whoa, no, what's the matter with me? I'm sorry. Minus 1. I'm getting myself screwed up here. R3. In other words, I just take these two pieces, divide them over here, and then subtract the one. That's all I'm doing there, is that mess right there. So just to show you this one more time. Oh, this is a lot like work. Okay. Okay, I'm going to take the 1.0412. And by the way, you might notice this is actually one of the hardest things that you'll learn in this course as far as math goes. And it's just like we just wear this mess, 1.0412 cubed. Y to the x3. Whoops, I didn't mean to do that. Three divided by 1.0399 times 1.0415. Close the parentheses, minus 1, 4.28. So the 2 to 3 year forward rate is 4.28%. Now, what's the upshot of this? I'll give you a little formula here. For the 1 to 2 year, you will take the 1 plus the actual 2 year rate squared divided by 1 plus the 1 year. That's how you'll get the 2 year. And I don't think you'll be driven any farther. The 2 to 3 year, you would do it as 1 plus the just the 3 year rate you see cubed divided by 1 plus the r sub 1 times 1 plus the r sub 1, 2 that you had up here, that you calculated up there. So each one gives you the ability to calculate the next in the chain. But that's a formula that you would want to use to get these forward rates if there's a question in the homework. You follow it? Whoa, 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 minus. Minus 1, sorry. But just do it that way and just kind of think about, well, if I think too much about this. But what we're seeing here, though, is the implication of market activity on the current view of interest rates in the future. In other words, I know that the markets are telling me that they think, not intentionally, but they're telling me they think that interest rates from 1 to 2 years in the time frame of 1 to 2 years out are going to be around 4.15 at the base, at the risk-free rate. And then they're also then telling us by the next in the chain that the perspective is that by the time we get to the 2 to 3 year time frame, interest rates will probably be at about 4.28% on the low end. And that's what I was talking about. Remember when I told you the yield curve? What we're probably going to see is right now we've got that inversion. What we're going to see is this part getting a little steeper. And then finally getting even steeper until we've got a normal looking yield curve again. That's kind of what you're seeing right there. And I'm showing you real life data, the real data. And you're seeing what the best minds, the traders of the world, in their activities in the bond market, are saying their expectation is. If your expectation is different, well, go with it. just like I thought that there was going to be a bear market today. But anyway, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.